on ChatGPT, almost 60% of India's messages were work-related to start with. Closer to end of 2024, we had another flip. And if you look at the data a year later, I think 65% of all our messages are entirely non-work related and about 35% are work related.
Ahmedabad, Gujarat actually is in the top 5 in coding. You wouldn't expect that. So you're seeing a part of the country that's not really usually known for tech, and there's obviously a lot of development happening there, that it suddenly starts standing out.
Hey folks, I'm Ashwin. I lead AI at Z47, and with me is Vikram, our managing director. Over the last 3 months, we've put together the most comprehensive view of how India uses AI. We've done this together with our partners from OpenAI and Zinnov. The report is a compilation of first-party data from OpenAI on how consumers and folks are using AI. And we've also interviewed over 100-plus CXOs with help from our friends at Zinnov. The data that's come in, this is super fresh. We're also looking at it for, I think, the first time. So you'll see us refer to the report a lot, but we're going to go through this with you guys. With that, the first thing that we'd love to dive into is, one, how India's consumers are using AI today. And the top line stats are the most obvious. We have about 100 million plus ChatGPT users. We're number two globally in usage, only after the US. And I think we lead in the mobile active users as well. So all of this is great. We're almost leading in AI usage. But the bottom line is, on penetration, we're 75th percentile in per capita usage. So I think we rank 76 out of 118 companies, 118 countries on AI at a per capita level.
Listen, India is a large country, and it always takes time for tech to penetrate to the country. I would say the overall consumer data is exciting. And
given that I've been investing for the last decade and a half, I've seen multiple waves of technology go through our country exactly like this. So, not exactly like this, because I've seen multiple waves go in, internet, mobile, and so on. But this time, it's just faster. As with every wave. I'll tell you some of the things that really stood out to me on just the pattern. So the first is just the geography and how it actually splits up. It always starts in the south. I know you called it the Bangalore Bros phenomenon, but that's just true. All tech, this was true of how PC internet took off, how mobile internet took off. It started in the south. Literacy is higher, access to high-end mobile phones is higher. All of that just points to the fact that it will start somewhere in the southern states. And that's true of AI as well.
But look what stands out. Delhi is actually number one in ChatGPT penetration. Not always expected.
Especially how large Delhi is. And you see that penetration being so high. Ahmedabad, Gujarat actually is in the top 5 in coding. You wouldn't expect that Ahmedabad would suddenly stand up. So you're seeing a part of the country that's not really usually known for tech, and there's obviously a lot of development happening there, that it suddenly starts standing out. Then you look at how different states are using AI, and you're seeing clearly states with lower access to services like education, services like health, start to use AI for the services that they don't have access to. Assam, for example, is 3x plus the national average on them using education in AI. Jammu and Kashmir, for example, is using health in such a big way that the rest of the country is not. So there's something to unpack there for founders, that where there is less access to services, where those services are more complex to deliver, you're clearly seeing AI make a big dent. And I'll come back to sort of this theme. But if you just take the top line stats, but then you start unpacking how AI is being used and how AI is going through the country, I'll say one, it's moving much faster. And this wave, you're seeing different parts of the country emerge much faster than they ever did.
Yeah. And I think it ties back to the stat where today, almost 50% of all of India's ChatGPT usage is driven by 10 cities that account for less than 10% of India's population. And it is this other 90% that's the penetration story that's pending to play out. And when you kind of dive into the rest of that 90% is when you unlock some of these use cases like education, healthcare, and so on. So it's a good like take towards founders as well that want to look beyond the Bangalore bro phenomenon and solve for the rest of them. But if we flip the demographic from looking at the geographical way it's used into looking at the age groups that...
Gen Z has taken over.
And this was very interesting. So when we looked at the age categories on how people are using AI, globally, it is this 25 to 34-year-old age group, the young working professionals that dominate AI usage. Almost 33% of all, or 36% of all of ChatGPT's global usage is driven by this age group. And India as well started here. We started with this age group dominating, and mid-24, it just flipped. And since then, the Gen Zs have taken over. Almost half of all our ChatGPT usage is driven by the Gen Z cohort, which is this 18 to 24-year-old cohort. And extremely young users, they're totally AI native. They go to AI for everything. It is practical guidance. It is writing, teaching, or studying. It is all their college homework. This cohort is growing up AI native. And that's the big wave that's going to enter our workforce.
See, this is super interesting because every brand, every young company in our portfolio wants to go after these Gen Zs.
Yeah.
And they're trying to get them on social media, trying to get them on communities. But where they're actually hanging out is on AI. And that means sort of AI answers, AEO is going to be much more important for Gen Z. And I see this at home, and my son is more Gen Alpha than Gen Z, but when I see... He lives in either ChatGPT and Claude and others, but that essentially means that there is a trust that he has there. He is more AI native than he is mobile native, which is very different from how our companies were built. Companies were built mobile native, then they were built mobile social, mobile content. Now it has to be mobile AI if you want to catch these Gen Zs. And I think it's a big, big shift, which I don't think most companies and founders have thought.
Yeah. And even the way, I think there's patterns of which people discover products and learn and come to, let's say, find something, figure out if it's for them and use it. And I think that journey of studying these was different earlier. And today, what does that look like? Like for founders building for this young cohort, if they're discovering everything on AI, then does that change the way founders also need to make their products accessible and how they kind of reach this population that's now growing AI native?
100%. And this conversation is already happening in a bunch of sort of boardrooms and stand-ups and so on. I think one thing that I'm seeing is there is a agent-ready website and agent-ready interface for almost everyone, right? And you're starting to see agent ready or for agents on every website. And pretty soon I can see companies launching which are only for agents. You and I won't be able to read the website, but agents will be. So that's one thing that's happening very quickly. The second is content was important.
Yeah.
Now content is everything. Because if the agent doesn't have a way to consume content and other agents are not referencing it, this doesn't matter. This is the equivalent of the before how page ranks worked to how social proof worked to now. This is actually essentially how your AEO is going to work. So I think it's a fundamental shift in top of the funnel as well as the funnel management and journey, which is all going to be AI-led.
Yeah. And I think it's played out. I know you love the AI portfolio fund manager sort of thesis. And it just wasn't intuitive to me initially. I was like, why would someone not want to take financial advice from a person? But I think that some of these emerging behaviors that we're seeing with the newer cohort.
We are seeing this across sectors. But I'll try to unpack where we are seeing maximum opportunity. Number one is where supply is scarce. So less doctors, less teachers. AI is actually huge leverage on that to provide more, either doctors able to serve more people or potentially AI doctors that can at least triage. So wherever there's less supply. Second, where access has been limited. So for example, financial services, yes, a lot of people have access to Jandhan accounts and UPI and so on. To real financial services advice, no. It's been both access limited, and there's also an intimidation factor for most people at the low income strata to walk into banks. We're seeing, you know, with apps like Ulka and so on, that users develop both trust and are much more vulnerable on these apps than they've been in real life, and therefore they're getting access to far better services and so on. And third, complex user journeys, where you need to actually make lots of decisions, exchange a lot of information before you can actually get on. And that was a friction point. For example, Razorpay's new agent onboarding experience or Agent Studio, you're now able to just pull, say, make Razorpay live and essentially pull all of your documents somewhere, and then the agent is actually onboarding you. So you're seeing this thing of less supply, access friction, complex journeys, all of those lend itself very well to consumer AI products or AI journeys.
Yeah. There's another interesting flip we noticed. And this is again the way India started to use AI first when it came out. On ChatGPT, almost 60% of India's messages were work-related to start with. And I think this was closer to end of 2024, we had another flip. And if you look at the data a year later, I think 65% of all our messages are entirely non-work related and about 35% are work related. Now, the way to read this data is it is just the natural progression of how penetration happens. You first, it is everyone who's using AI who is at work finding ways to kind of unlock productivity there. And then once it reaches the masses, you see this unlock on the rest of the use cases that open up. We are still a few percentage points above the global average on work. So India is still, I would say, compared to the world, a work-first sort of market. And I think that results in differences in the way we engage with ChatGPT as well. It shows up in the breakdown of how India engages with ChatGPT. So if you look at this, the graphic on OpenAI's, let's say, categorization of the different types of messages or the different types of themes that people use it, we're similar to everybody else on writing, information seeking, multimedia, and so on. But when you look at the technical help or technical writing component, there we're twice as much as the world's traffic. Almost one in four messages is entirely focused on technical help, and that's twice how the rest of the world uses it. And I think it's very similar to our population as well and to where you see penetration coming from.
Some of these numbers are big, right? It's 4x on data analysis, 3x on average on coding. Asking coding questions is also 3x. Education is 2x on average. And then you pick the top 10 cities. That becomes 9x on coding analysis and codex, 30x on data. So some of these pockets are just astounding, where it is India is much more evolving differently, where India is, I mean, if you look at Git, you'll see that India is a nation of developers and coders, and that's reflecting in the data as well.
Yeah. No, funnily enough, on GitHub as well, we're, I think, now the largest developer base, most obvious answer. But even if we look at contributions to AI packages, I think we're number two in the world.
Yeah.
So I think, one, we've unpacked some of the interesting stuff on how consumers use AI. And there's a lot more in the report as well. But we should switch gears to what we saw with the enterprises.
So before we get there, I think on the consumer AI section, I think there's a few themes, right? Yeah. AI following very similar trajectory to other technology waves. It looks like AI is democratizing access to services, to different parts of the country and so on. And three, for Gen Z, AI is sort of everything. We are going to, I think we're going to open source this report on a site, so it's going to be accessible to a lot of people. As you guys dig through the data, we'd love to hear from you. what you're seeing in the data, which is hitting you differently.
So let's switch gears into how Indian enterprises are adopting AI. And we spoke to over 100+ CXOs. We made sure we cover the large Indian enterprises, the Reliances, the Godrejes, along to early stage companies, many in our portfolio like Atomic, Dashtoon. So we got that broad spectrum view of how India is using AI.
Let's give a quick shout out to Zinov for doing a lot of these CXO interviews, especially in the traditional space, and to all the founders who participated. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, and out of the 100, 95% of all of these Indian enterprises have meaningfully adopted AI. It's no longer the question of whether people are adopting it. Almost all of them have adopted it in a meaningful scale. And there's about 5% that's still experimenting. They haven't sort of opened it up to the org and so on. We cut them into four distinct archetypes. And we had this neat 2x2 emerge where on the x-axis, you have all of the early adopters and the mature adopters, depending on how they've kind of inbuilt AI into the org. And on the y-axis, you have the mode at which they started to adopt AI. So you have folks that adopted it bottom up, like this PLG, all the folks at within the org kind of using AI. And then you also have folks that had it as a top-down strategic mandate where AI was kind of enforced across the org. And that lent us to like these neat four beautiful archetypes where you have the tinkerers, you have democratizers, you have transformers, and enforcers.
So you have two guys who unfortunately or fortunately were trained in consulting systems, different ones, but we ended up with a 2x2. But hopefully, for me, it actually put in context the internal chaos as well as transformation that we are going through as a fund. I would say all of us started as tinkerers. Ashwin wanted to solve his own problems. I have the marketing team in front of me. Vineet and Madhvi wanted to solve their own problems. I wanted to solve my own problems. Avnish was creating problems and then solving them. So everybody ended up as tinkerers. And at some point in time, we just said, hey, everybody needs to use it. And we ended up on that democratizers bucket. I would say we are in that midst of going from that democratizers to transformers bucket. Somebody actually said we are actually furthest along towards that journey. But I'd like to challenge ourselves to say, are we truly strategic enough what we are seeing with the transformers? So it gave me a very nice way of thinking through where we are on this journey and where we need to get to. And I hopefully for founders and CXOs, this gives a way to anchor the discussions within their companies.
The way they kind of got bucketed into these four archetypes is also interesting. I'd say most of them, about 25% of them fall in this tinkerer bucket where every employee has their own ChatGPT subscription. Everyone's using it for their own personal productivity gains to write emails, code better, and so on. And once all of them evolve into becoming power users, where they're building out agents for their own function, like a finance AI agent, or they're building out something to drive a team-level productivity, that's when they kind of migrate to democratizers. 30% of all the users we spoke to fell in this bucket. And that's a natural progression that a lot of them have seen. And the next stage is when you get this strategic mandate, a top-down mandate kind of enforced across the org, where it's now an org-level mandate of using AI. You put together systems, you put together platforms to move these democratizers to the next level. And 20% of most Indian companies now fall in this transformer bucket, which is the North Star. The one tricky spot to be in is this enforcer bucket. It's again about 1/4 of all the enterprises are in this enforcer bucket where there is this top-down mandate. Everyone's made a big push on AI from the top, but it's just not met from the bottom layer and adoption kind of just hasn't taken off.
So I'll tell you what was interesting for me is how these different buckets are deriving value. Everybody's getting some value, right? And there's some lift from AI, but it's very different on how each of these buckets is deriving value. If you look at the tinkerers, it's the productivity lift that you get immediately.
Yeah.
You're starting to write email, you're starting to automate some activities within your function. Your essentially individual output is suddenly up. You're doing the work of 1.5x, 2x, depending on how you're using AI. Suddenly that productivity is up. But then when you think of, hey, is this working cross-functionally? Is marketing talking to sales, talking to tech and product. And is that happening? That's not happening with the tinkerers.
Yeah.
Then you move to the democratizers and it gets interesting. There's a lot of bottom-up experimentation. There's some cross-functional things that are happening. They are picking up either tasks to be done or workflows. And then they are automating those workflows and saying, hey, how can we take two or three critical workflows across the organization? And then we're starting to automate it. You're seeing hackathons happening within that org where they are saying, okay, this is a big idea that we can actually all work together and we can put something out. It will show up in a customer experience use case where product and tech is also involved and something nice has been delivered back to the user. So that's if you're doing something like that, then you're in the democratizer bucket.
We saw this also, the thing that stood out here was almost 30% of them reported some kind of new business model where AI has kind of played a role in. And that was evident. It's the highest in all the archetypes. And it's that clear payoff of distributed experimentation. You can't plan for this top down. You let 100 people play around with it, and then a bunch of them are going to come up with great ideas, and that just feeds back into the business.
What was also interesting for me is for a lot of the democratizers are potentially companies which are a little bit younger, and therefore they don't know any other way of working. And the only way they know how is an AI native way of working. And therefore they are discovering all sorts of new products, new businesses, very organically, because they have these different pods going off and saying, how can AI be applied?
Yeah.
There's very few that are making it to the transformer bucket. I think it's pretty interesting what is happening there, because there the ROI can be clearly quantified. The way the top team founders, CEOs are talking about it is that, hey, this is the new way in which we work. It's an operating model change. It's a business model change. And therefore, you're seeing a direct impact on P&L. Not just on sort of cost efficiency, but actually a new way of operating, which is leading to revenue expansion, different types of growth funnels that are coming in, which might be efficient, or being able to attack new users like Gen Z and so on. So the ROI is unquestionable. I'll talk a little bit about one journey. And, you know, yesterday Harshal was here and he was talking about how he started as a tinkerer. And I have not seen him this excited about technology in a while, and I've known him 10 plus years, and he was super excited and animated, and hopefully we can insert a clip of him talking about it.
I tried OpenClaw for the first time around end of Jan, and I set it up and I'm like, wow, like, this is just going to change the world, because, and not the product itself, but just this capability now that the model has. I think so. For the first time, I started picking up and building products myself, like I think after 6 years maybe. And started building stuff with it, started tinkering with it, started using it to set up a agent to do like meeting review notes for me, started using it to do a diet plan for me, and being a dietitian for me, and all that. I just started doing a bunch of stuff. I think after I set up OpenClaw, I think for 3 to 4, 5 days, I think people in the office said, like, I don't know where you are, but you are completely distracted, because I couldn't focus on work at all. I was like just logged into this, testing its limits, testing what it can do, testing what I can do with it.
So they started as tinkerers, then they ended up being democratizers, because everyone wanted to, they just gave these tools to everyone, and everyone started using it, and the AI generated code took off. But there was still a gap on them becoming transformer. And he was talking about a hackathon that they did, which was not bottom up of getting people to develop ideas, but the top team had to develop ideas and pitch it to the rest. And so it was sort of like the equivalent of a reverse pitch, where the top team was pitching and the younger folks were judging that. Harshal said he came fourth very proudly. And in that, that's when the transformation started happening, because the top team started buying in. And then it was sort of both sort of the bottom up motion of the democratizers and the top team thinking strategically on, hey, this can really change the way we do things. And that has now seeped into the DNA. So I thought that journey of going from tinkerers to democratizers to transformers, I thought it actually worked really well for them.
I also liked what Rahul Chari at PhonePe had done, where there was this tinkerer cohort and there were really enthused folks that were using AI every day. They started to become power users.
And then what PhonePe did was they said, okay, let's get all of these power users.
They turned over the keys.
Yeah. And they're like, let's enable them, make them this center of excellence for all things AI. And then they've sort of started to drive that.
So they went from tinkerers to transformers by turning over the keys to the tinkerers.
Yeah. The one archetype out of all of this that you need to be cautious of is this Enforcer archetype, where there's just been this top-down push for everyone to use AI. But the bottom layer just hasn't witnessed that magic. They haven't played around with it. There hasn't been a culture to adopt AI.
So you're saying I should stop measuring token usage of every person?
If you enforce token usage on people, then we're going to just bleed tokens and we're not going to see the ROI, which is actually what happens here. If you look at that Enforcer archetype, almost one in five of them can't really quantify what ROI they're getting. And there's the rest that have done it well have seen some productivity gain and some cost reduction game. But this archetype, the one thing we've noticed is if you don't follow the progression of enabling the bottom layer to kind of start using AI, you get bucketed in it. And for founders that, let's say, are that feel like they're in this Enforcer archetype, there's a few things that you can do to break out. And what we heard is, one, internalize some of this AI capability. What we've noticed most enforcers do is 50% of them, a lot of that AI mandate has been driven by an external services vendor. They say we need AI, they get a services vendor. So the first step to kind of avoid it is, one, internalize some of that capability. Have people within the org use it. Bring some folks in to...
But why is that different this time around? Like when we had to do an IT transformation or a supply chain transformation, external vendors worked.
The difference, I think, lies in just the way people discover some of these use cases. With AI, you can't have a ready reckoner mandate to give a vendor. It's not, I need SAP S/4HANA, here are the 10 things and here are the 4 ways I need it deployed. With AI, once people use it, that's when they can truly start to discover all of these things. So it is this sort of moving puck. And it's the way we started. We said, hey, we want this to automate the CRM. Today, we've kind of taken that from there. Yeah. All the way to saying, we want an investing member that's capable of unlocking, showing us the biases and taking a decision.
So I view it a little bit differently, that overall tech so far has been used to automate a task that you already know can be done. I think the power of agentic you discover because you're able to create a teammate for yourself. Yeah. And therefore that is actually a very personal experience and very contextual to that org. Yeah. So for example, right now we are trying to create an associate teammate or a coach. That associate and coach for Z47 is very, very organic and personal to us. And unless we are playing with it, no vendor from outside actually can help you create that teammate. And that teammate actually is going to not be a great teammate when you first create them, just like you were on day zero. But then we spend time, we have chemistry, I ended up spending a lot of time with you, and then now we gel and then we work really well together. That's the same thing for an agent. So I think unless you really experience this in your hands and are actually invested in it, like you would be invested in a teammate, you're not actually going to get the agent that you want.
Yeah. So yeah, going back to that, if you're a founder and you think, oh shit, my org is in this enforcer trap, there are a few things you can do to kind of get out of that and move into one of the other archetypes. And the first thing starts with internalizing this capability. Do not outsource from day one, but have a team, an internal platform team or an internal AI center of excellence, folks that are able to use it and discover use cases for the company itself and create that culture and that urgency to use AI. Second, measure outcomes and don't just measure adoption. So have this kind of baked into your P&L, have the BU leaders, have the CFO, have all your leadership bought in on it and have them each drive some of this AI adoption at a board level. Don't just build this internal team and say, you guys figure it out. You need everyone in on it and everyone kind of bought in on that journey. And the last one is use some of the mandate to enable this bottom-up adoption. So, get rid of the friction. I'm not saying, I know you have security concerns that I might not care about as much, but there is a way to meet somewhere in that middle to take off the friction from a budget standpoint, enable people to use it.
See, if you're in that enforcers bucket, the mandate is sort of working and the mandate is how you're used to working. You have a command and control type of org, and that's how you've driven change. So use that to your advantage. Use the mandate, trigger the democratization, and make sure that you're getting these power users in, and then hopefully you can go down the path of those power users sort of taking the rest of the org along. And that might actually work better because the top-down clearly isn't working.
And it's a clear pattern again. When you're in the early stages of your adoption, most blockers are around security and around integration difficulty. Here, people are figuring out security. They still figuring out how they integrate it with the rest of the org. And most of their concerns when they're looking to adopt AI as well lie in this bucket because there's just not...
Let me bring you into our firm. I think we have had... there was a period of time, I think we were having a daily stand-up on security because each of us was building different things. It was driving my partner Rajat has turned even more gray because he's the person, he's the warrior of the group and he heads compliance. And for him, the fact that so many people were building so many things was creating a humongous headache. And at some point of time, I think we had to shut down everything internally for 4 or 5 days, and we have a internally we have a EIR Krish who helps us build, and he's our most used and loved resource because everybody wants to build something with him every day, and he had to just fix compliance guardrails and security guardrails for 4 or 5 days, and then we could go again.
We rallied all our portfolio founders together as well, where I think we got Scalekit to come in, protect all the secrets, variables, everything. We had Guard Zero, the DVC portfolio company, come in to give us observability governance. We also brought in SkyDA to surface alerts and anything critical. And I think now we have RealFast coming in to tie everything together, make it a little more enterprise grade. So it's like our portfolio, Krish, everyone kind of rally together to say, okay, let's get you guys back on track.
And I think this is normal that if you're going down this tinkerer to democratize the journey, the thing with AI is that the attack surface, yes, grows and the security vulnerabilities also grow. But it also exposes all the security vulnerabilities that you have already had in the system for a long period of time. So you're actually already exposed. You just don't know it yet. The agent just figured out much faster that you were exposed. So it is just natural that you will go down this path. And I think you just have to get through it. And that's what we're seeing with the early folks being continuously worried about security and integrations. And then you're crossing over to the other side where then you're saying, hey, my data is not in an architectural format where it's actually usable by agents. It's too slow, or it ends up drifting too much because we don't have the right micro context for it to execute in, or we actually need both model quality as well as model cost is starting to push us where we're saying, okay, hey, do we really want to add another $100,000 resource for this? Or is this to be done by a $25,000, $30,000 resource? So I think those are the questions that the people on the mature side are starting to ask.
So we've spoken about how consumers use AI. We've also gone over how enterprises are adopting AI in India. I think we should take one step back and look at this more from a national scale. What does AI mean for us in the grand scheme of things?
So we've talked about consumers, we've talked about enterprises, and you know, let's try and pull all this together. Does it matter for the country?
Yeah.
And that's the question that we are asking after the big AI summit on how much of this is real and what can it mean. I thought the overall Viksit Bharat target was a good way to anchor this. And it looks like we are roughly 4+ trillion today. The target is 8.3 trillion. If you take our current growth, which is 6.5%, you will end up missing that target by a trillion, right? We'll still end up getting there. I'm saying that target in that same time frame, you'll end up missing by a trillion. The question is, can AI actually bridge this gap? And for us, we do think that there is an opportunity that if, as a country, we are able to use AI in the right way, both top-down and bottom-up, then we will be able to potentially bridge the gap. And I know people always ask, how does this happen, right? You know, you're just making this either use AI, then $1 trillion.
And there is this cloud. There's this like cloud of pessimism where everyone. It's the question we keep getting asked is also India hasn't yet had its one massive AI outcome compared to our global counterparts. So how much of this is more than the bullishness on paper versus what it gets translated to?
So one, let's just bridge this $1 trillion gap on what happens to in order to bridge the $1 trillion, because you need, what is happening on the ground is that you either have to discover new revenue streams or big productivity games where the same people are doing a lot more work. Both are possible with AI, with the Indian ecosystem. You're already seeing that consumers, customers who were hard to serve before, you can serve with AI, which means that you have new revenue streams. And hopefully the productivity gains are sort of obvious because we are seeing that across all of the different orgs. And a lot of the India friction of getting stuff done, hopefully we are able to minimize, and therefore we are able to do a lot more with the same time. Right. So that's the gap. And if the US is thinking non-incrementally about how fast their economy can grow with AI and getting their economy back on track, for us, this should be a big force multiplier. So that's the just completing that thought. And on the pessimism, where did the pessimism come from? It's just that the world, especially the US as a center, has had this wave of ML, AI researchers for the last 10 years or more. And then AI has happened suddenly, overnight, but on top of 10 years of execution. So we need to be a little bit more patient with ourselves. Then when you think of all the tech waves that have happened before, you take mobile, you take a thing like WhatsApp, or you think payments, IT services. India was never first to the game. In most of these waves, we might be last to the game. I would say in AI, we are reasonably early to the game. But the scale that India achieves is always larger. So I think you came up with this. What was your line?
India is rarely first, but always the biggest.
So I like that. This rarely first, always biggest classification of how India adopts tech. And we'll try to put different waves of technology there. And maybe we'll take some of the recent waves, mobile and digital payments, because they were just sort of the fastest growing ones. And truly, we have the largest ecosystems, the largest mobile internet base and largest digital payments ecosystems. And all of these, you are seeing this Act 1 on emerging globally, and then Act 2 of India adopting, and then India just amplifying and scaling at population scale. And you can see that that's happened with mobile very, very quickly, digital payments even faster. But there are some catalysts that are needed at different points in time. Mobile needed this catalyst of Jio. Payments needed this catalyst of UPI. And then there is the event of demonetization, which actually put it on steroids. So we do need to introspect on what are the catalysts that are needed in order to make AI successful on population scale for India. And we've looked at a few things. I think the first thing that we really need is the first pillar, which is compute. And you like to say compute is going to be like electricity. And while we've been recording this podcast, it's been pretty choppy, the electricity. So hopefully the compute is better. And for AI adoption at population scale, I think our compute costs and the way we think about compute costs has to be completely, completely different. And I know you have some data on how some of the compute is coming up, but I do think we have to think of both the way we construct our data centers, but also then the models that our compute costs are far lower than what the global models can give us.
And if we spend some time on compute, I think today India has roughly 200 to 250 megawatts in GPU capacity. And what we'll need by 2030 is almost 300 times more. We're going to need close to 7 gigawatts of GPU capacity. And 90 to 95% of this demand is purely going to be inference-led. We are an inference market and not a training market. So this massive explosion in capacity would probably have the hyperscalers like AWS, Azure, catering to 50% of it. And I think they've already made $65 billion in commitments. There are a few more coming down. But all of that would get them to just half that capacity. The remaining half will have to be provided by sovereign providers. And we have early companies that are sort of catalyzing this again, like NESA, a portfolio company of ours, that started to set up our own sovereign clouds, sovereign GPU capacity. And we'll need a lot more of these players to kind of fill in the remaining gap on what we need on compute.
And you're just seeing this big gap on domestic cloud, right? And if I was a founder looking at this chart, I would be immediately figuring out where can I get the real estate, where can I get the power infrastructure in order to be putting this up. Yeah. And you're seeing this, one of our, the largest data centers is coming up in Vizag. And you're seeing states look at this chart and say, how can we actually make our state a great center for compute?
Yeah. We should switch over to one of the other catalysts that we're seeing, which is just on the talent front. One, in terms of AI talent, I think 20 out of the top 100 of the best AI companies in the world has an Indian co-founder. So we have that capability. We have founders that are building all of this. It's just not in the Indian pin code yet. And I think we'll figure out ways to get some of them back. There are programs to kind of have folks come back, the reverse brain drain that we can do. But walk us through what our talent edge could be here.
I think overall, we've said this before in different podcasts, but AI is failing at production scale.
Yeah.
And in order to make AI pilots work at production scale, there is an overall retooling that needs to happen within the org. Some of it is that the data architecture isn't the right way. I have a podcast with the Axel Data founder where he talks about how data pipes need to be reimagined in order to actually make this work. Even within our org, we are seeing, hey, if we don't organize our data in the right way, our models are drifting or they're just not working fast enough. Compliance, risk, and governance seems to be a huge topic on any enterprise-grade task. And then agentic harnesses, where we're just seeing that it almost needs every org needs an individual harness tailored to itself if you need to make AI work like a true transformer, which is running the business. All of that build requires massive talent, which is used to both delivering to enterprises as well as driving change management through that. And frankly, the talent in India is tailor-made for that. The one place where I'll disagree is that we are seeing founders from India and Indian founders globally take on big challenges both in India as well as global challenges. And here I might sound like a big bull on India and Indian founders, and I am. But we are seeing those kind of opportunities emerge in our portfolio as well as being able to invest in the landscape. So I'm a big believer that the overall India startup ecosystem and India diaspora is going to have big outcomes in this space. We'll just have to think about it differently. I'm very confident we will, because that's the way each wave has gone.
The third pillar is data. And I think wave one of everything generative AI was pre-training massive data sets, pre-trained models. And the next wave of where all the frontier labs are spending time is just reinforced learning. And with RL, I think it lends itself to a different set of data requirements. You need real-world data, you need domain-specific data, you need experts to kind of label some of this data, and companies are paying top dollar for this. India today is the richest country on the planet in terms of data.
So we end up being a data colony.
The question is actually, how do we avoid being this data colony, and how do we look back 10 years from now saying, oh shit, we did it again. We paid by the hour. So, I don't know, I'll throw that to you. Like, what do you think India needs to do to avoid becoming the data colony?
Yeah, I guess you mean we're renting our data by the hour. And I do think we need to play it smartly. The first wave, like you said, was essentially, first wave of AI models was trained on the internet. That was free.
Yeah.
This is not free. This is our data. And we need to say, hey, it is not free. Now we need to actually figure out a way to monetize this in a way that is advantageous to us. How is it advantageous to us? We have to anchor it in the fact that unless it is serving Indian users in a non-incremental way, it's helping Indian healthcare in a non-incremental way, it's helping Indian education in a non-incremental way, helping Indian financial services in a non-incremental way, we're not sharing. It has to be that there is an investment by anyone who is training these models on Indian data, that they are investing in some way, shape or form to actually building the India ecosystem. So, and there are ways of doing it. I think the best model that we have had is around DPI, which was a digital public infrastructure made for India, made for Indian costs, and really reimagining the way a population at this scale should be interacting with each other. But then the data was used by global companies, but in a way that is only advantageous, that is advantageous first for Indians, and then we were able to export it. So I think there is a model there that we could use. The other part of this, which I'm very bullish about, and I know I say this DPI to the power AI from the rooftops, and of course, this is something that is coined by Nandini Nilekani, the AI mission and so on. And but India has a unique advantage of having Aadhaar as its unique identifier tied to biometrics, and then the data stack then being tailored, being mapped to that identifier. I think it leads itself to a personalized AI assistant like nothing else on the planet. You're starting to see that happen at AI checkouts. You'll start to see that with AI healthcare. And I know there's always this trade-off on privacy versus service. And I'm on the more on the benefit side. Yes, I value my privacy, so I would like control over my data, which the consent layer does. But if you can democratize more and more services in this country through that, I think that's a major, major advantage that we have. So use the data smartly such that we use it to our advantage, where we're taking the world's interest and converting that to the world's investment into our AI ecosystem.
I think with that, it brings us to the last piece of this, which is Indian companies that are playing a big role in the AI ecosystem. And that's, of course, also where we spend most of our time. And I think over the last 6 months, we were looking at how much capital has gone in. It's, I think, 24, there was about 630 mil that was poured into AI companies. By end of 25, that doubled. I think there was a total of $1.2 to $1.3 billion in capital raised by companies. And we've got folks across the stack. So infra and foundational models, about 16% of all this funding has gone there. Horizontal enterprise, that stayed steady. About 40% of all dollars have gone into horizontal AI companies. Vertical AI was the breakout. I think 37% of all this funding went to vertical AI companies, and we're seeing a lot more solve for very niche deep problems. And of course, India has its consumer AI ecosystem. So we've captured companies that are doing great work across all of these. It's in the report, but this is just a start. India's AI ecosystem is way larger than this, and it's constantly evolving. We're seeing new companies come out, new problems that we're solving, founders going after a lot more ambitious global problems that they're solving. So this is a start. It will be on our website. And if you're a founder who we've not put on this yet, please do reach out. There's an evolving landscape, and we want to capture all of India's companies doing great work in the space.
Hey, I want to thank you for leading this effort. I know it's taken a lot of late nights and early mornings. And thanks again to our partners at OpenAI for their time and also being very generous with sharing the data and insights with us. And the Zinnov team who's worked very hard on this. And all of our team internally, which is sort of helping to amplify this message. Like Ashwin said, this is a start for us, where we are open sourcing all of this data and insights out to you guys. I think when you look at it from your context, you will end up discovering something that we will not be able to see. And we'd love for you to share it with us. Mail in, maybe we'll do a quick reel with you so that we can understand how you went from a tinkerer to a transformer. So we'd love to share some of these stories and, of course, add to the AI landscape map. Look forward to it.
You're watching Z47 Moments, the podcast by India's oldest venture capital firm, Z47. If you like this episode, consider hitting the subscribe button and the bell icon so you never miss an update from Z47 Moments.